This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll introduce you to a new talking doll that has privacy watchdog groups up in arms. Equipped with a Bluetooth microphone and a mobile app, the doll, My Friend Kayla, elicits personal information from young children that is then transmitted directly to a software company. Attorney Jeffrey Haas delivers a dispatch from the protests at Standing Rock. He'll explain what's happening with the outstanding lawsuits, the pipeline construction, and the overall state of the encampment. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. Several consumer advocates are urging retailers, including Amazon.com and Walmart, to stop selling a doll that can eavesdrop on children and their families. The groups are calling on the retailers to discontinue sales of the doll called My Friend Kayla after filing a complaint in late 2016 with the Federal Trade Commission. The complaint alleges that Kayla and another toy, the IQ robot, which isn't sold in the U.S., can transmit recordings to Nuance Communications, a speech-to-text software company that contracts with military and law enforcement agencies, among others. The doll, made by interactive toy maker Genesis, is a wireless-enabled device that advocates say can open the door to hackers and other privacy violations. In a letter to Amazon CEO, Josh Golan of the Campaign for a Commercial-Free Childhood wrote, quote, "My friend Kayla poses significant security risks that could place children in physical danger. A stranger or potential predator within a 50-foot range can easily establish a Bluetooth connection with the doll, eavesdrop on the child, and even converse with the child through the doll." A similar letter, also signed by the Center for Digital Democracy and the Electronic Privacy Information Center, was sent to Walmart, Target, and Toys R Us. Toys R Us said the doll is no longer for sale at its stores or through its website. Joining us to talk about My Friend Kayla and the privacy concerns related to it is Josh Golan, Executive Director of the Campaign for a Commercial-Free Childhood. Josh Golan, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me again.
Tell us how the doll My Friend Kayla is marketed to parents and children.
Sure. So My Friend Kayla is a doll. It's connected to the internet, and so it can have conversations with children. And it's marketed as really like being a companion to kids. It can remember things about what they say and then reference them in conversation. So the idea is that the child is really forming a relationship, or at least that's the way that it's being marketed.
Now, technically, how does she function in terms of the equipment that enables her to speak and gather information?
The way it works is when you buy the doll, you download an app, and then the doll connects to to your smartphone, to the parent's smartphone, presumably, via Bluetooth. And then through the app, information is then sent to the cloud, where it is stored on a company called Nuance Communication Server. So then the doll is accessing that information that's on that cloud and sending information to that server as well.
And does the doll respond to a child's questions, or does Kayla come up herself with questions to the child with the goal of eliciting information?
Kayla actually is usually pretty much drives the conversation, so it's not particularly advanced enough to where Kayla is able to do a lot of answering of questions. So Kayla asks questions of the child, and that's one of the ways that it elicits information from the child. And that's one of the concerns beyond all the privacy and security concerns that we have with these dolls. You know, from a creative play standpoint, with internet-connected dolls, one of the things that happens is that the doll is really driving the conversation and eliciting all this information from the child rather than it being child-directed play, which is really the best thing from a child development standpoint.
Right. Give me an example of some of the questions. Does Kayla ask, you know, what's your favorite color? What do you like to eat? Is it that type of question?
Yeah. So they ask questions about the children's likes and dislikes and their interests. And exactly, it's those types of questions. So
It's building a profile, as it were, of a young consumer.
Absolutely. And that's, yeah, and that's not necessarily unique to Kayla. It's kind of, it's the way these new internet-connected dolls work. They elicit a lot of, they're designed to elicit information from the children.
Talk, if you will, a bit about nuanced communications. I understand they have some relationships with the military. What do they do with the information that they collect from Kayla? Is a profile created on each doll owner?
You know, it's a little difficult to know what they do with the information they collect from Kayla, because they haven't been particularly forthcoming about what they do with the information, and their privacy policy is very confusing. But here's what we do know. They maintain a huge database of voice prints, which they sell to law enforcement and to military contractors. So they're, you know, what they are maintaining is a voice print, so they can recognize who a person is by their voice. What we know is that they also are the processor for my friend Kayla, and they say that the information that they collect from Kayla will be used to enhance their other Nuance's other products. So we believe it is very likely that children's voices are going into this massive database that they are building on people's voices, and then could be shared with law enforcement or the military. They have not responded to whether that's happening or not, and so it's very it's very concerning. And reading the way their privacy policy is constructed, it seems very possible that that's what they're doing.
So this is in essence a biometrics database.
Exactly.
Now, don't children's voices change as they mature, or does the essence, from what you know, remain the same over the decades?
You know, that is a fantastic question, and one that I don't really know the answer to. So I don't know actually whether if you were recording a kid at 6 years old, whether you would then be able to identify them at a later date. You know, but we don't think there should be a database of children's voices regardless, even if it's not going to hold up over time.
No, I mean, some of the fears obviously from a civil liberties perspective are that, just as with DNA, any
yes.
government or corporate managed database with information that could be stored indefinitely could then be used to go after people if there's a specific crime, or there could be profiling. I want to get to the claim made by the Campaign for a Commercial Free Childhood, the Electronic Privacy Information Center, and some of the other consumer watchdogs who are against having dolls like this on the market. There's a claim that toys subject young children to ongoing surveillance and violate privacy and consumer protection laws. Can you talk briefly about this, in addition to keeping a database of voice prints? What are some of the other concerns of how this information may be improperly used?
Sure. So the Children's Online Privacy and Protection Act, or COPPA, requires companies to be very explicit about what they're going to be doing with data collected from a child, and to get parental consent before they do any types of sharing. And the privacy policy for this doll is not explicit. It just says that it will share it with third parties for research purposes to improve the toy, but it doesn't necessarily say who those third parties are. I mean, it doesn't say who those third parties are. So what our concern is that the doll is eliciting, you know, all this information about a child's likes and dislikes, and so that information will then be sold to marketers, so that you have a profile on a child about, you know, oh, this child has a dog, this child likes this cartoon character, this child likes to go horseback riding. And so then that, you know, that's information that's incredibly valuable to marketers. And so we're very concerned that that one of the purposes of this doll is to build marketing profiles on children. And they're not clear with parents about what they're doing with this data. And the other thing I would say about this is, you know, with all apps, it's, you know, unfortunately, the privacy policies are written in ways that are deliberately confusing, that are too long, you know, that we all do it. We're all guilty of checking off privacy policies, that we don't have the time or patience to wade through all of it. But when you're talking about a toy, it's even different because you don't even see that privacy policy until you download the app. That's your only chance to see the privacy policy. So if you've already shelled out $70 for Kayla, and your child is excited about playing with this doll, and then you do happen to wade through this, you know, extremely long, difficult to understand privacy policy, you're in a terrible bind. Are you then going to, you know, take this doll away from your child because you're concerned about the privacy? So we think that, you know, with these dolls, they should be very upfront before the point of purchase about this is exactly who what we're going to be doing with your child's data, and we absolutely won't share it with any type of third party.
It's interesting you mentioned taking the doll away because, of course, there's another angle, and that's that a child will get attached to the doll, which makes removal, if parents want to get rid of it, even more difficult. You know, I read that in Germany, the counterpart, which is the robot called IQ, has been taken off the market. You referenced COPPA, the main vehicle for protecting children in the United States. As we compare to other countries, are we less stringent in terms of our protections for children than, say, Germany?
Yes, there are stronger protections in the EU, and I think even more importantly, in the EU and in some of the EU member states, there's stronger enforcement. So, you know, I think something like there's only been something like 20 enforcement cases by the Federal Trade Commission, COPPA enforcement, since the law was passed in almost 20 years ago. So, one, their laws are a little more robust, but two, they have more enforcement, and I think that's really the key. You can have the law on the books, but if you're not really holding companies accountable and enforcing them towards best practices, then, you know, the law, it doesn't really matter what the law is.
Right.
And I would also say, you know, the biggest problem with COPPA is that if you get parental consent, you can do just about anything with a child's data. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the privacy is just such a hard issue to wrap your head around if you're, you know, I do this for a living, and it's I have difficulty understanding a lot of the language in a privacy policy, particularly, and as I said, they're deliberately written to be confusing, so we'll consent to things. And so, really, a better privacy law would be one that said you cannot do these things regardless of whether you're getting parental consent when you're talking about children under 13. We just shouldn't be allowed to collect personal private information from children and then share it with third parties.
You mentioned in terms of marketing, is it correct that my friend Kayla, the doll, subjects young children to Disney product placements specifically?
Well, my friend Kayla talks about a tremendous number of brands and products, and there are a lot of references to Disney. We asked the Federal Trade Commission to investigate whether that was paid product placement. Disney has since come out in press statements and said that they had nothing to do with it, that there was no deal there. But, you know, that is certainly one of the concerns with dolls like this, is that they can become marketers themselves, particularly as they begin to understand children's interests. You know, my friend Kayla talks about how much she loves shopping at Target, and how, you know, she goes on and on about Target. You know, we don't know if there was a deal there or you know, there's no way for us to know these things. So that's one of the concerns with these dolls, is that not only will they be used to collect information, but then their conversations they will be having with children will actually be to push them to get excited about brands and products.
That is a horrifying revelation. I had no idea she mentioned names.
Yeah,
she's actually a talking
ad. Incredible how many brands and products and media characters she talks about.
The producers of this doll must be marketing geniuses. We mentioned my friend Kayla recently on a Law and Disorder fundraiser, and we couldn't help but laugh and compare the doll to the Twilight Zone episode called Talkie Tina, where Telly Savalas, the actor, is a gruff father, and his child gets a talking doll who generally says, "My name's Talkytina, I love you." But she takes a dislike to the father and starts to change her tune to, "I think I don't like you," to, "I hate you." And then it ends with, the doll calls him up on the phone one night and says, "My name is Talkytina and I'm going to kill you." And then he falls down the stairs because she's lying on the stairs and he dies. But we played a recording of the doll, and it was hilarious but also extremely ominous, but nothing compared to a doll that now spews out literally ads to a young child. I would think that if parents heard that, they should be horrified.
That, and, you know, when we've talked to parents about it, they certainly have been horrified. But I think one of the things that happens with these dolls is that, you know, parents have no idea. They just, you know, they're kind of dazzled by the idea, oh, my child could be having a conversation with this doll, and the doll is going to remember things about my child, so it's going to be more, you know, it's going to be a more in-depth conversation maybe than, you know, the old dolls that would just say, you know, the same four things over and over again when you pull the string. And so, you know, I think parents are understandably kind of wowed by the promise of the technology, and they don't understand till, you know, we're able to investigate and explain things to them that the potential for these to be, you know, ad delivery systems and data collection devices.
Can you talk a bit, if you will, about the other initiatives that the Campaign for Commercial Free Childhood is working on, and maybe how you see the talking doll that collects data and shares it with a corporation fitting into this sort of the theme of what you're fighting against?
Sure. So the Campaign for Commercial Free Childhood, you know, we work to protect children from the harmful effects of advertising. And, you know, it's a brave new world when it comes to children and advertising. You know, when I started doing this job back in 2003, the main thing we were still concerned about at that point was television advertising. And obviously, the marketing industry has evolved in some really concerning ways since then. And one of the things about children is that they are developmentally vulnerable to advertising. They don't understand persuasive intent. They don't understand that the information they're getting from an ad is different and biased in a way that hopefully information they're getting from a teacher or a parent isn't. And so they're already developmentally vulnerable. But as advertising becomes more and more hidden and more embedded into conversations or programming, it's even harder for children to defend against it. So one of the things that we see is on the internet, there's just no separation between advertising and programming the way there is on children's television. You know, we'll be right back after these messages. There's an advertisement. It looks different, but on the internet, increasingly, the program itself is an ad. So one of the things that we've been working on a lot in the past year or 2 years is there's this whole genre of videos called unboxing videos, where they started out where parents were filming their children opening a toy and uploading them to YouTube, and these became very popular videos. And what happened is the toy companies started seeking out the kids who made these videos that were very popular with other kids and started paying them and giving them toys. And so now kids are watching essentially 12-minute toy commercials, and they have no idea. Their parents have no idea that these are toy commercials. They just think they're watching, you know, a kid that's like the kid down the street opening a toy. So that's an example of how the boundaries are disappearing between programming and advertising, and how that's both confusing and unfair to a child. And then what we're seeing with these toys, which is why we focus so much on these toys, not just My Friend Kayla, but a doll called Hello Barbie last year, is that even without the screen, children are being exposed to advertising, and that their information is being collected. And so one of the things that's, you know, with the internet that's happened is that huge marketing profiles are being built on every single one of us. And that's happening with children. And so, you know, it's happening on the internet. That's why, you know, certain ads follow us around. And when that happens to children, when they move from site to site, they don't understand, you know, we barely understand as adults why we're seeing that ad, you know, that just happens to fit with our interests or what we were looking at 10 minutes ago. With children, they certainly don't understand that. And so that's very powerful. But then when you combine that their actual play with toys is then being, you know, commercialized and being used as part of this huge marketing machinery targeting children, becomes even more concerning. So, you know, these dolls fit into our work in that, you know, there's an industry that's trying to collect as much information and deliver as many marketing messages to children as they can cram into their waking hours. And so we're trying to fight for rules to protect children from that and also educate parents about what they can do to lessen some of this marketing assault on their kids.
I think if parents were aware that data aggregators were amassing information and building a profile on young people, they would probably want the data aggregators, I would think, to have an age below which you were not allowed to do that, so that you have to be 18 before aggregators are allowed to start gathering, storing, and marketing your information. Is the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, the primary regulatory agency to air your complaints about privacy violations and misleading advertising aimed at children? Okay. And just on a final note, what has the response been to your organization and other groups' complaints about my friend Kayla? Has the manufacturer said anything?
Well, interestingly, the manufacturer has gone into hiding. So literally, I mean, there have been, you know, hundreds of stories about this doll since we first filed the complaint in December, and they have not commented to anybody. But, you know, the good news is we have been able, in the United States, we have been able to convince Walmart and Toys R Us and Target to stop selling the doll. So major retailers have stopped selling the doll here in the United States, and in other countries that's happening as well. And obviously the very important ruling that happened in Germany about not selling this doll anymore. So even though, you know, we have not yet at this point been able to get the Federal Trade Commission to act on our complaint, we have been able to get, you know, three major retailers to pull the doll, and also through the tremendous amount of publicity that we've gotten for this effort, I have to think, you know, millions more parents are aware of the concerns about this doll than before we started doing this.
Congratulations on that. If listeners want to get involved or learn more about your work, where can they go?
Our website is commercialfreechildhood.org, and you'll find out all sorts of information and also links to our Twitter and Facebook there.
Josh, thank you so much for the wonderful work you continue to do and for once again joining us on Law and Disorder.
Thanks so much for having me, Heidi.
I would love to play together. Maybe you can ask me a question. See if you can stump me. My ultimate job or purpose is to make children happy. If I can help them learn something in the process, that's even better. I try to do this every day. It's something programmed inside of me.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org. In early February, under orders from President Donald Trump, the Army Corps of Engineers approved an easement allowing Energy Transfer Partners to drill under the Missouri River near Dakota's Standing Rock Sioux Reservation. Standing Rock and neighboring tribes are trying to halt the project in court, and pipeline opponents have embarked on a so-called last stand, holding protests and actions across the nation. Authorities set a deadline of February 22nd for the protesters to clean up and return home. At the main encampment, trucks are hauling away garbage and abandoned goods. Some protesters are relocating to higher ground nearby on the reservation. In preparation for the evacuation, dozens of North Dakota police and National Park Service rangers had surrounded the camp. Joining us to talk about the construction, the encampment, and the many pending lawsuits is attorney Jeffrey Haas. He has been delivering dispatches for Law and Disorder since the camp's inception. Jeff Haas, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
It's been a while since we've spoken, and a lot has happened, including the installation of a new president. And today we're actually catching you on the day when the authorities have asked the protesters to leave the camp. Can you give us a sense of what's going on there and what's been going on for the last few days? How are people feeling?
Yeah, well, I was there at the camp actually last week. And the people that are left in the main camp are the Ochetti camp, maybe 300-400 people. They started really trying to clean up the area. People have left a lot of things behind, everything from teepees and trash to cars, abandoned cars. And also because of the early warmth in North Dakota, things were 2 inches deep in mud because the snow was melting. So conditions were a little difficult, but people had sort of those who were still there, many were banded together to try to clean it up, and they actually had some support from the tribe with some heavy machinery, and also from, I think the Oglala Sioux had offered some heavy machinery. When I was there, the Army Corps of Engineers, they've given them a notice that they have to be out by the 22nd, but they came in last week and said, we want to observe and figure out how to help you or how to clean up also. So there was sort of a standoff publicly on a bridge between the people in the camp and the Army Corps, and they agreed to let some observers in. And then since then, for the last week, I think they've been working together pretty regularly because everybody wants to clean it up because there's a possibility of a flood and everything that would be left in the camp might end up in the river. So there's been cooperation for the last week of people actually cleaning up heavy equipment, picking up their personal belongings. However, a number of people in the camp say, well, once it's cleaned up, we don't intend to move. We may go to higher ground within the camp to avoid a possible flood, but we're still going to stay here. They're facing an eviction notice that starts today at 2 o'clock. And they can be served by the Army Corps of Engineers with trespassing citations, which carry, I think, up to a $5,000 fine. The Army Corps does not have exactly a armed unit, but they have the authority to bring in local police. And so it's possible at 2 o'clock the police could come in and do a sweep or try to do a sweep. The people inside who say they're staying, they say they're not going to be violent. They're going to be praying. They have a right to be there. They feel that not only is it treaty land, but also they feel that the struggle, as long as there's a stand there, then the other efforts like the divestment movement and the support around the world will continue. So I'm not sure exactly what's going to happen. After today, the Army Corps of Engineers has also said they will not allow anybody in after 2 o'clock who has left.
Jeff, I understand that the numbers right now are around 300 individuals there. But on the other hand, we're seeing a surge of activities across the nation in solidarity or in protest to other pipelines. Why do you think the numbers have diminished at Standing Rock?
I think a number of things have happened. There was a blizzard. And it's very difficult to live in a non-permanent structure when it's wind chill 30 or 40 below and a lot of snow. I think they have some of the support that the tribes were given has been withdrawn, so some of the facilities have been taken out. It's very hard to survive in this situation. Also, the actual drilling, which has gone on a little distance away from the camp, has been protected by law enforcement, and they've been given the permit to go under the river. Some people say they've already completed that drilling, and the oil, other than testing oil going through the pipeline, it's been completed. So it's somewhat of a symbolic gesture. There's so many encampments. When you're up there on all the hills, there are all these surveillance vehicles and armed vehicles. You feel like the camp is totally surrounded. It's sort of like in a valley with the military on all sides of them, including Turtle Hill, which is a sacred site. So I think there's the conditions, and then some people have actually, there's a new camp set up just south of there, which is not on Army Corps land, which is on reservation land, that has been set up, and so people are going there. I do hear there may be some veterans coming back, and there are two other camps, the Camp of the Sacred Stone and Rosebud, that also have people, but that are not on Army Corps land. Even though the Sacred Stone camp has been given an eviction notice by the tribe to leave sometime next week. So I think a combination of the conditions, the difficulty of actually protesting at the pipeline, just the weariness and the difficulty of giving up your life and being out there for so long. And then it's been taken up around the country. As you said, so many cities have had so much have actually had protests, and then the divestment movement, which is focused on Bank of America and Wells Fargo. In Seattle, the whole city divested $3 billion in funds. I know here in Santa Fe, we have a resolution to divest. So I think it's been taken up nationally and internationally. It's a difficult situation at the camp. As I said, the pipeline itself looks like an outpost from Iraq. I mean, it's got concertina wire around it. They put a missile there that has special surveillance equipment. I think all of those things contributed to the difficulty of maintaining a large presence in camp.
Jeff, several lawsuits are still pending. Can you give us a brief summary of the litigation underway?
Yeah, well, initially, of course, this is a suit in Washington, D.C., that the tribes filed against the pipeline, saying they had not complied with the regulations with regard to doing a proper environmental impact study and also a historic preservation study. So it was based on two regulations, and that went on for a while. And then the judge denied the TRO or the injunction there. Meanwhile, at the same time, because of pressure and so forth, the Obama administration then withdrew the permit for DAPL to go under the lake and the river next to it. So for some period of time, they did not have the authority to go under there. And actually, the Obama administration said, we need an environmental impact statement, which requires a study and it requires comments. This was something the Army Corps of Engineers did right before Obama left. It wasn't an executive order, but somehow the Trump people, when they came in and when he got elected, the Army Corps of Engineers really gutted that process. It takes a while, and the public's allowed to comment, and they're really supposed to do a study. But instead, they finished they never really finished an EIS, and they granted the permit back to Dakota Access Pipeline to go the last half a mile under the river. The suit then was revived to try to stop that, saying you didn't go through the proper procedures, and that has been denied. So there is still some pending litigation, but it may be somewhat moot since I think the pipeline has actually completed its process. I guess subsequently they could say that it was done without the proper impact and they could delay it, but it doesn't seem likely at this point the courts are going to intervene to stop the flow of oil through the DAPL. I think there's a part of the pipeline, maybe in Illinois, that's not quite completed.
Hmm.
On the other hand, this delay and the continued delay, the pressure put on the banks could make it very difficult financially for it to work out. There are a number of loans that have been granted, and they've made contracts with producers of oil that are no longer lucrative because the price of oil has gone down. So how much that impact could play on whether or not the pipeline is feasible, that could play out.
I wonder if there are measures that President Trump might take to make sure that there are no obstacles or delays.
Well, they removed the biggest obstacle, which was to do an environmental impact statement.
Right.
And so they just sort of did away with that whole process.
Mm.
So that would be the mechanism to slow it down. And so now that physically it's basically built, I think it's going to be difficult unless somehow the investors, and there are increasing internationally pension funds and unions that are looking at the banks and saying, well, we may take our money out of your banks if you're going to continue to loan money to the pipeline and to the corporations behind it,
right.
Energy Transfer Partners, particularly in Enbridge.
Mm.
So I guess the economic boycott could still cripple the pipeline or cripple the corporations that are doing it, but I think physically it's going to be difficult to stop the completion of the pipeline and oil coming through it.
Yes, that's true. I know. I work for a nonprofit, and several nonprofits who have investments are increasingly talking to the entities that manage their funds to make sure they're not in pipelines, or even the banks that are the custodians of the funds. So this is, I definitely think it's spreading in terms of public awareness. Are there any lawsuits remaining, Jeff, that were brought by individuals or any criminal cases pending?
Yes, there's about 700 criminal cases pending, and I've been one of the people involved in that. They've been escalating the charges. What usually started as misdemeanors have now become felonies. Riot becomes inciting a riot. Criminal trespass becomes enhancing danger. So there are many, many cases that are pending. We've done a jury survey that shows it's 88% of the people in the two counties around the pipeline have strong feelings against the protesters. They have dismissed some of the trespass cases because they did these mass kettling arrests without either signs saying you couldn't trespass or any warning. They would just come on people and arrest them. They've just recently done a federal indictment of five people who were accused of blocking a road and setting a barrier on fire, and they're facing a charge of interfering with commerce, and then by doing with fire, it's a 10-year mandatory sentence. So what would normally be some kind of obstruction charge is now a federal, very serious felony. And then North Dakota has passed laws that increase tremendously the fines for protesting, for rioting. They've already have a case where people were walking across some railroad tracks, and they're accused of tampering with machinery or with railroad commerce, even though there was no train. But it made a felony out of what was really a misdemeanor and or should have been. And so there are quite a few very serious charges still pending. I'm not sure what's going to happen today, if there are going to be more charges. 99% of the protesters have been peaceful, and against them, law enforcement has escalated and have come out totally armed and have used rubber bullets, have used beanbag grenades that have exploded, and two people's eyes have been seriously damaged. They use massive amounts of tear gas, and they use water cannons a couple of times in sub-freezing temperature, several people got hypothermia. So there's a lawsuit against the, around the tactics that the supposedly non-lethal tactics, which have injured numbers of people and are not proper for dispersing a crowd that's not threatening any law enforcement. And they use more or less for punishment on people who would dare to come out and protest.
Right.
So there is a lawsuit in North Dakota District Court. Unfortunately, the judge in that court has denied the preliminary injunction, saying he's seen enough on TV to know that these protests are, quote, violent, or even if some of the people are violent, they had a right to use this weaponry. And so he, based on evidence that second, third-hand commentators, he's denied the preliminary injunction.
Hmm.
So we are appealing that. So that civil suit is sort of in limbo right now.
If I could go back for a minute to the criminal cases, Colin Moynihan, a New York reporter and writer, has a piece in The New Yorker about what he calls the mess of all the cases. And he writes that the officials in North Dakota are rescheduling many of the protest pipeline cases so that the oldest ones are tried first and to give the parties time for discovery and motions. Apparently, the large number of defendants is presenting real logistical challenges for Morton County. And what I'm wondering is, do you think that some of these cases may be dropped because of the limited ability to prosecute them?
Well, that's a good point. One of the things that happened is North Dakota pro hoc vice law required out-of-state lawyers, if they were going to practice there, to have an in-state lawyer with them all the time. So through the Lawyers Guild, have recruited quite a few out-of-state lawyers. But until the North Dakota court ruled last month that they didn't have to have a North Dakota lawyer with them all the time, it was difficult to bring them in to try cases. Now we're bringing them in, and we've recruited a number of North Dakota lawyers. A lot have been appointed. And it's true, these cases now have spread out. And just last week, they dismissed three cases because at the end of the state's case in a jury trial, they had not proved that they had given warning to people not to go on the land, or that there were signs, or that they were given an opportunity to leave. And there are a lot of these cases where there were just these mass arrests without warning. So I think some of those cases they're going to have problems with. Otherwise, they have set them out as far as June already, and there's still some that haven't been scheduled for trial. So they do have a bottleneck in the court. They have a problem with that. And some people have, even though in the case, the one case where people went to trial, they gave them large fines, I think sort of as punishment. Prosecutor wanted them to pay for law enforcement. And the judge couldn't do that, but instead he gave a $1,000 fine on a B misdemeanor, which local lawyers said they'd never seen before. So I think the fact that they've overcharged a lot of these people and the fact that they've haven't gone through the necessary steps to prove trespass or maybe riot will result in a lot of these cases getting dismissed. On the other hand, I think they will seriously prosecute their people who have locked down on equipment, and they're charging them with reckless endangerment, a felony. There were people on the railroad tracks who were charged with felonies. There are people who are now charged with inciting a riot from a recent action. So I think the more serious cases, they will continue to prosecute. It's going to be difficult for those cases that do go to trial to win. We've filed a motion for change of venue. Thus far, it's been dismissed sort of summarily, even without a hearing. So maybe we'll get a little more opportunity to expose how prejudiced people are in the more serious cases. And we'd like to try to get those cases out of the Mandan-Bismarck area.
I read that in one filing by the prosecution, they've said that, quote, out-of-state activist lawyers are directing protesters to clog jails and court systems. And that because of that, the individual who wrote it says pipeline defendants do not deserve the free defense provided to those who can't afford a lawyer, and that, get this, the court may seek reimbursement to the state from pipeline defendants represented by court-appointed lawyers. Had you heard that?
Oh, absolutely. And now they're charging people for their public defenders. And
oh,
the prosecutor
really?
Said he'll even issue liens and follow them if they don't pay them to whatever states they come from. And they're saying, just like you said, well, it's out-of-state lawyers that are behind it. These people wanted to get arrested. They only want to be out there for social media. And the prosecutor has put out a steady stream of this anti-protester bias.
Hmm.
You know, they're outsiders. They're not from here. You know, sort of like in the civil rights movement when all the trouble was supposedly the outsiders coming in.
Right.
And so yeah. that is one of the ways they try to portray it. And it's been effective, certainly with the federal district judge. And that local judges are under a lot of pressure. They have to get reelected there, and there's a strong that this anti-protester or anti-water protector sentiment has been built up a lot by the comments of the sheriff, who always describes them as violent, and by the prosecutor, who describes them as ill-motivated, you know, outsiders, people trying to. At some point, he said the real purpose of the demonstration is to break the financial back of Morton County.
Hmm.
That people want to get arrested, they want to exhaust the legal resources and the courts, and therefore they should be given some of their constitutional rights, like the right to a lawyer and a fair trial, should be abrogated, since their motives are to disrupt the county and break the county financially.
Astonishing. Jeff, we just have a few minutes remaining. Is there anything we've missed that you'd like to mention?
Well, I think the spirit is still there, and I think it's alive in spirits around the country, maybe even the world. I think young indigenous people have been inspired by what the nations have done there. I think it's an example of people coming together. Yes, there's a lot that remains, including criminal cases, but I also think the struggle that was ignited there, and that brought together environment, brought together indigenous rights, brought together water, and the fossil fuel and global warming was really significant. And we saw people from so many different aspects coming together around this thing that's so connected to the survival. So I'm sure that spirit will continue, and I'm sure they're going to, I don't think it's over at Standing Rock. I think we're going to see continued resistance there and around the country, inspired by the stand that's been taken at Standing Rock. I guess I want to say personally that both the cause and the size of it and everything have really impressed me, but I think just the absolute bravery of some of the people there and their principles and their willingness to put their lives on the line is really powerful. And I think when you come away from there, having met and seen and broken bread with many of those people, you really come away impressed. It's always sort of the people who put their lives on the line that inspire everybody else to be at their best.
Mm, a remarkable initiative. Jeffrey Haas, you also have been so generous with your time and reporting, and we thank you for everything you've done on the ground. So we look forward to talking to you after this recording.
Okay, yes. It will be an interesting week for sure.
I know. All right. Take good care, and thanks again.
Yes, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.
Law and Disorder has been broadcasting for nearly 13 years now. We started on WBAI in New York City and are now carried on nearly 100 affiliate stations across the country. We'd like to take a moment to thank them.
WBAI 99.5 FM, New York City. KRFP 90.3 FM, Radio Free Moscow, Moscow, Idaho. WRFN 107.5 FM, Nashville, Tennessee. KSOW 106.7 FM, Cottage Grove, Oregon. WYAP 101.7 FM, Clay, West Virginia.
KRFC 88.9 FM, Fort Collins, Colorado. WRCT 88.3 FM, Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. KWMD 90.7 FM, Kasilof, 104.5 FM radio, Anchorage, Alaska. WXOJLP 103.3 FM, Northampton, Massachusetts.
KEIF FM 104.7 FM, Enid, Oklahoma. WPVM 103.9 FM, Asheville, North Carolina. ISPCA Radio, Indiana, online to Chicago. Motion Community House Radio, online.
WLRI 92.9 FM, Gap, Pennsylvania. WPRR 1680 AM, Grand Rapids, Michigan. WCRS 102.1 FM, Columbus Community Radio. 98.3 FM, Central Ohio. KKFI 90.1 FM, Kansas City, Missouri.
Free Radio Santa Cruz, WSLR-FM 96.5, Sarasota, Florida, KDX Internet Radio, KDX World Around Radio, Lorain Community College Radio, WHUS 91.7 FM, Storrs, Connecticut,
WJFF Radio Catskill 90.5 FM, WDRT 91.9 FM, Viroqua, Wisconsin.
That's where I used to go fishing with Michael Ratner.
WERU 89.9 FM, Blue Hill, Maine. 99.9 FM, Bangor, Maine. Redwood Community Radio.
KMUD 91.1 FM, Garberville, California. KMUE 88.3 FM, Eureka, California. KLAI 90.3 FM, Laytonville, California. Voice of Sacramento 88.7 FM, Sacramento Community Radio.
WWPM MediaNet, Nokomis, Illinois. Community Radio for Cape Cod, WOMR 92.1, Provincetown, Mass., where I grew up. WMHC 91.5 FM, Mount Holyoke College, South Hadley, Mass., where I did three semesters.
You dropped out.
KSER FM 90.7 FM, Everett, Washington.
WHUS 91.7 FM, University of Connecticut. Free Radio Olympia, Olympia, Washington. WCRS, LPFM, 98.3 FM and 102.1 FM, Columbus, Ohio. KSKQ 94.9 FM, Homegrown Radio, Ashland, Oregon. WAZU 90.7 FM, Illinois Central College, Peoria, Illinois.
WGCX 90.7 FM, Community Radio, Greene and Columbia Counties, New York. WGCX 90.7 FM, Community Radio, Greene and Columbia Counties, New York. KSVR 91.7 FM, Skagit Valley Community Radio. KYRS 92.3 FM and 89.9 FM, Thin Air Community Radio, Spokane, Washington.
WQVR, The Eye, 1640 AM, Sandersdale, Southbridge, Massachusetts. WFTE 90.3 FM and 105.7 FM, Scranton and Mount Cobb, Pennsylvania. Rochester Free Radio, WRFI 91.9 FM, Watkins Glen. WINO 89.9 FM, Odessa, and 88.1 FM, Ithaca, New York. WEFT 90.1 FM, Champaign, Illinois.
Radio Phoenix, Online Community Radio, Phoenix, Arizona. Boston Free Radio, Geneva Community Radio, your voice for many voices in the Finger Lakes. KAOS 89.3 FM, Olympia, Washington. KWTF, Sonoma County, California.
Radio Free Kansas, Northeast Kansas. KBOO 90.7 FM, Community Radio, Portland. 100.7 FM, Corvallis. 91.9 FM, Hood River. WSCA 106.1 FM, Portsmouth, New Hampshire. WZRD 88.3 FM, Chicago, Illinois.
KOWA 106.5 FM, Olympia, Washington. WRIR 97.3, Richmond, Virginia. KMEC 105.1 FM, Ukiah, California. KSVU 90.1 FM, Concrete, Washington. WXPI 88.5 FM, Williamsport, Pennsylvania.
KNSJ 89.1 FM, San Diego, California. KGHI 91.1 FM, Westport, Washington. Our streaming planet podcast. WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington, D.C. KPFT 90.1 FM, Houston, Texas. 89.7 FM, Huntsville, Texas. 89.5 FM, Galveston, Texas. WOOL FM, 91.5 FM, Bellow Falls, Vermont. Black Sheep Radio.
KGIG 104.9 FM, Salida, California. KEUL 88.9 FM, Girdwood, Alaska. KRDILP 103.1 FM, Duval, Washington. WUMD 89.3 FM, University of Massachusetts, Dartmouth. KWRKLP 90.9 FM, Alaska Peace Center, Fairbanks, Alaska.
WGRNLP 94.1 FM, Columbus, Ohio. WOOC 105.3 FM, Troy, New York. WHYRLP 96.9 FM, Baton Rouge Community Radio, Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And Workforce Rising Online.
Thanks to all our affiliates. If you're not on this list and would like to be, please contact lawanddisorder.org, our producer Jeff Brady, so we can count you among our growing list of stations, and we'll notify you of upcoming programs and specials. Thank you.